is here. Now, broadcasting from the underground command post, deep in the bowels of a hidden bunker, somewhere under the brick and steel of a nondescript building, we've once again made contact with our leader, Mark Levin.
Hello, everybody. Mark Levin here. Our number, 877-381-3811, 877-381-3811. I'm here in the Florida bunker. I hope you got to watch Levin TV last night. I went deeply into North Korea, not knowing, of course, that there would be another ICBM, the most sophisticated of them all yet, fired off by North Korea. We'll get into that later. I've been watching the debate over the tax cuts like you have and trying to figure out they are, where to get the money from and how to grow the economy, and it gets more and more difficult, more and more complicated. They get more and more in the weeds. Then we watch today as Schumer and Pelosi did their drama queen act, in which they decided that they weren't going to sit down with the president to decide how to come up with even a temporary spending plan to prevent the government from shutting down, quote unquote. And as you and I know, it never shuts down. But in the future, it's going to get worse and worse. Because problems are piling up that future politicians, future Congresses, and future presidents are going to be incapable of resolving. They're going to be incapable of resolving. Because the laws of economics, as I've said 1,000 times, will catch up with the laws of politics, and the laws of economics will win out. And just as demographic changes in this country over the last 10 to 15 years have made it impossible to address illegal immigration, to secure the border, and even high levels of legal immigration. It's made the politics almost impossible, based on the mindset in Washington, D.C., as more and more states turn purple and then turn blue. So, too, when it comes to this massive debt that gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Bigger and bigger and bigger. And all we hear from Republicans and many of their pom-pom boys and girls is class warfare propaganda. And this is what it's going to come down to. Now, I want to thank the Daily Wire, Ben Shapiro's operation, which is an outstanding operation, and Spiridon Mitsotakis, who is a terrific young conservative, for writing a piece about me, and I'm not going to read it to you, on how I conduct this program, how I write my books, what I try to take, what I try to project in terms of thoughtful commentary and writings and so forth to advance conservative principles. Now, why do I advance conservative principles? Am I some kind of a goofball ideologue who's out of touch? No, because they're the only principles that can save us. Conservatism is about how we live our lives. It's not an ideology. It's an experience. It's principles based on human experience and rational thought. And there's less and less of that, which is why we're moving further and further away from it. And people come up with their own ideas. Populism, nationalism, progressivism, and all the rest of the isms. But this fight over the budget, these fights over tax cuts, which in the end will screw many of us, by the way, but these battles are going to become worse, more difficult, and even violent at times. I want to take a little time with you and chuck everything that I prepared for the program. 5 minutes before the program began, I said, you know what, I'm not going to waste your time and my time delving into what is on some of these websites. We can get into that later. But we allow ourselves to be driven by the agenda of the left, of the media, and others. And we shouldn't. We have big issues to address in this country. So I want to talk to you about this in a very intelligent way. In Plunder and Deceit, I write about this in chapter after chapter after chapter. George Mason University economics professor, Dr. Walter Williams, always one of my favorites, rightly describes the underlying pathology driving the nation to economic and financial ruin as a moral problem. We've become an immoral people demanding that Congress forcibly use one American to serve the purposes of another. Deficits and runaway national debt are merely symptoms of that real problem. And as Williams states, nearly 75% of today's federal spending can be described as Congress taking the earnings of one American to give to another through thousands of handout programs such as farm subsidies, business bailouts, and welfare. And what I'm about to say tonight may upset some of you. Dr. Thomas Sowell, senior fellow at the Hoover Institute, Stanford University, notes that there was a time when the purpose of taxes was to pay the inevitable costs of government. To the political left, however, taxes have long been seen as a way to redistribute income and finance other social experiments based on liberal ideology. They're both right on. And I point out the consequences for the rising generation. This is what I call the young people. I don't like generation this and generation. Rising generation and future generations of the status immoral, politically expedient, and economically ruinous behavior and policies are unambiguous, as evidenced by statistic after statistic, which are mainly ignored, discounted, or excused by most of the media, academia, and, of course, governing statists. But there's no mistaking the eventual societal turmoil of these facts and figures portend, evidence all Americans, and especially younger people, must heed. The nation's fiscal operating debt was $10.6 trillion on the day Barack Obama took office in January 2009. By the end of January 2012, the fiscal operating debt had increased 44.5% to $15.4 trillion. As of April 12, 2015, remember this book's a year and a half old, the fiscal operating debt was $18.152 trillion. It's actually now over $20 trillion. A 71% increase in less than 6.5 years. Each man, woman, and child on this country's share of the national debt has grown from $33,220 at the beginning of the Obama presidency to almost $57,000 two years ago. To be sure, the debt habit began long before the Obama presidency, but it is now a full-blown addiction. During the Obama administration, government spending and borrowing have both skyrocketed. The financial bailouts and expanded social spending during the prior administration of George W. Bush contributed mightily to the federal government's debt. In fact, Bush is second only to Obama in the amount of debt in absolute dollars with which he burdened younger people and future generations. But with the addition of the massive Obamacare law and the other profligate spending programs, including some $800 billion for the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, a so-called stimulus program, there's no denying that the past several years have created historic records for yearly deficits and overall debt, from which we have yet to cut ourselves. As C. Eugene Sterley of the Urban Institute explained, over decades we have wound a straitjacket policy around ourselves, especially in retirement, health, and taxation, budget areas where now dead or retired members of Congress inscribe permanent policies. Annual decision-making and regular review have been choked off, and future generations saddled with the tab or forced to raise the resources to meet these past promises. In 2014, the Congressional Budget Office released its annual long-term budget outlook. Now, that's 3 years ago. The document provides an extensive analysis of projected government spending, debt, and obligations. It reported that between 2009 and 2012, just 3 years, the federal government amassed the largest budget deficits relative to the size of the economy, that is, the gross domestic product, since World War II. And what did it get us? These deficit levels were almost twice the percentage of the deficit at the end of 2008. Measured in dollars, the federal deficit in 2008 was nearly half $1 trillion. By 2012, the deficit, the yearly deficit, was $1.4 trillion. In 2014 alone, 3 years ago, the budget, the federal budget deficit, was larger than the combined market capitalization of Apple Computers, ExxonMobil Corporation, and Microsoft, three of the world's largest corporations. Just the annual deficit. Now, economists discuss the budget deficit in terms of its percentage of GDP. For most of the 40-plus years before 1998, federal debt held by the public was on average 39% of the economy, GDP. But when the unprecedented deficits that began at the end of the Bush administration exploded at the beginning of the Obama administration and swelled further during the course of the Obama administration, the total amount of federal debt held by the public in 2014 rose to 74% of the GDP from 39%. Assuming the current laws remain in place, federal debt will reach 103% of the economy, of the GDP, by 2039, about 20 years from now. CBO's long-term projections do not incorporate, they do not incorporate the negative economic impacts that are projected to accompany the government's debt burden. When the economic impact is calculated, it is estimated that the debt burden will reach 111% of gross domestic product by 2039. That is, the debt burden, not just the debt, the burden, will be so massive, it will be hugely larger than all of the economy. Moreover, debt would be on an upward path relative to the size of the economy, a trend that could not be sustained indefinitely. And this is when you have an eventual collapse of the civil society, as you see in Venezuela, as you saw in the Weimar Republic, pre-Third Reich. Increased public debt also means increased debt servicing costs, particularly when the Federal Reserve eventually discontinues its artificially low interest rate policy, which has been going on for a decade and 2 years, for 12 years. When the feds start to raise interest rates, rising interest expenses to the Treasury is going to exacerbate the climb in the deficit, according to economist Michael Eglund of Action Economics. The increase in interest payments by the federal government will consume a still larger portion of the federal budget, thus increasing the gap between remaining revenues and government benefits and programs. Interest payments are expected to more than double relative to the size of the economy. The yearly deficit, the overall debt, the massive interest payments keep climbing, 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 climbing. And you have people talking about free college, and you have people talking about single-payer health care, and you have people talking about a new trillion-dollar infrastructure program, and you have people talking about family leave programs, trillions and trillions and trillions that speed up the eventual destruction of our economy, and hence the civil society. No discussion whatsoever about what I'm talking about. None in terms of addressing it. Ever-increasing federal spending exacerbates the national debt problem. For most of the past 40 years, federal spending has averaged around 20.5% of gross domestic product. But in Obama's first year in office, federal spending spiked to 24.4% of GDP, the highest level since World War II. In both 2010 and 2011, expenditures were 23.4% of GDP. Even with sequestration cuts and follow-on budget deals, spending was 22% of GDP in 2012, nearly 21% of GDP in 2013. And let me remind you, folks, that the Republicans controlled the House of Representatives for nearly this entire period. And let me remind you, folks, that the Republicans controlled the Senate for the last 2 years of the Obama administration. Now, some of you are going to be upset about what I'm about to say. But those of you who are on Social Security and Medicare, when they collapse, most of you will be unaffected because you won't be here anymore. But there will be generations left who have to deal with this. There is not a plug nickel in either of the Social Security trust funds. It's all been removed and it has all been spent. The only thing that's in Social Security trust funds right now are IOUs. From the Treasury Department to the Social Security Administration. The same with Medicare. Social Security and the federal government's health care programs, Medicare, Medicaid, Children's Health Insurance Program, and subsidies related to Obamacare will double in relative costs over the next several decades. For the past 40 years, they have together consumed on average 7% of GDP, but they are expected to increase to 14% of the GDP by 2039. Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid account for 60% of the government's non-interest expenditures in recent years, steadily growing as a share of annual federal expenditures. Now, I'm going to dig into this. If it's too tough to take, I understand you'll go off and do something else. That's fine. But I need to deal with this. My conscience tells me I have to deal with this. While all the Mickey Mouse stuff's going on in Washington, all the Mickey Mouse stuff's going on in the media, I have to address this. We'll be right back.
Mark Levin.
Gosh, you're throwing all these numbers at me, but you can look them up. Or you can go to the library and get my book and look them up. They're all out there. The point is, I'm trying to, I won't say inspire, but instigate some interest in this. So you're not stunned one day when all this smacks you in the face and all of a sudden the irrelevancy of the lightweight hosts all over the media, the stupidity of the members of Congress, and their utter uselessness, the grandiosity of this bureaucracy, this federal leviathan. I mean, I have people calling me on this program telling me the reason we have all these wonderful goods in the grocery stores is because of regulations and government, and people want lots and lots more of it. I know I'm a lone wolf. I know I'm the only voice. I can't help it. And I'm not done. We'll be back right after the bottom of the hour. I hope you'll stick with me.
The Mark Levin Show, live and national at 877-381-3811.
As a side point, this Luis Gutierrez, and good riddance to him, has decided he will not run. One day after he had made the announcement, or had prepared his papers to file for re-election, he reversed his course in hours. Yes, I'm quite suspicious about that, given what's swirling around. No, I'm not making any specific accusations. But I suspect there's more to this than meets the eye. But in any case, good riddance and get lost. Now, the Democrats, just to give you an example, they have thrown the gauntlet down to the Republicans and the president that either they meet the demands of their constituents and their spending profligation, or they're going to shut down the government and blame it on Trump. They want more hurricane relief, especially for Puerto Rico. They want this DACA matter resolved in their favor. And they want an increase in the debt ceiling. Or they're not even sitting down and talking. They control nothing, and yet they control everything. Because we have about half a dozen Republicans who might as well be Democrats. McCain, Collins, Murkowski, Corker, so forth, so on. And they don't put the country first. They're caught up in their own politics. And that's what I'm trying to point out to you. So let us continue. In 1970, social programs accounted for 32% of total federal expenditures. Social programs grew to 44% of federal expenditures in 1980 and 1990, 54% in 2000. They were promoted as safety net programs for the protection of the poor, elderly, and vulnerable. But in each case, the programs have snowballed and have become unsustainable. CBO expects their spending percentages to continue increasing indefinitely. Although this topic will be addressed, and I address it more fully later in the book, suffice it to say that the Social Security benefit cost explosion has been predicted for decades. There are currently 58 million people receiving Social Security benefits. By 2024, 6 short years, that 58 million will grow to 77 million. By 2039, a little over 20 years, there will be 103 million eligible beneficiaries. Average benefits are on the rise, as is the number of people qualified to receive benefits. Over the next 10 years, there will be a 38% increase in the number of people over 65 years of age and entitled to receive Social Security benefits. By 2039, there will be an 82% increase in the number of those who are over 65 years of age. Increases will be caused in significant part by the influx of retirees and beneficiaries and the outstretched benefits promised by these programs, particularly with the huge expansion of federal health care spending. Over the next 10 years alone, the percentage of people reaching retirement age will grow from the current 14% to 21%. Concurrently, the number of income-producing individuals will drop from 60% to 54% of the population. That trend to continue as life expectancy increases. That means there will be fewer taxpayers available to pay the freight, a crushing burden imposed on younger people and future generations. This is the future. And if there wasn't already a brilliant book written with the title Future Shock, that's what I would call this. It's Future Shock. Although this will be it merits mention here. Federal spending on health care increased from 9.5% of GDP in 1985 to 16.2% of GDP in 2012. God knows what it is today. But CBO projects that based on current trends, the federal government's health care expenditures will mushroom to 22% of the GDP by 2039. Now, I want you to think about this. The debt's going to consume the economy. Federal expenditures on entitlements, like health care, will consume the economy. Student loans are going to consume the economy. They're coming at it from all directions. Now imagine being me and writing a book like this, going through all this research on weekends and late at night for a period of a year to 16 months. And I'm looking at this stuff and I'm saying, I've got to write this. I got to write it fast. I have to write it well. I have to make it compelling. I have to tell my fellow citizens there is cause for alarm. And then nobody gives a crap. In order to pay for these ballooning expenditures, payroll taxes will grow significantly over the same period of time. Yet another enormous weight dropped on the heads of the next generation and future generations. Not only is federal spending out of control, it is also inefficient and poorly monitored. Why am I going over this? Because nobody else is. A report issued by the Comptroller General of the United States disclosed that duplicative or overlapping federal spending programs exist in 132 areas, from teacher training to job training. Improper payments by 18 different federal departments in 2012, 5 years ago, cost the federal government a whopping $107 billion in 1 year. So bad is the federal government's management of its massive resources that the General Accountability Office found, that's the GAO, found the accuracy of most of its financial reporting suspect. In its latest audit of the federal government, the GAO concluded there are significant and material weaknesses in the accounting performed at all levels of the federal government. Among other things, this is just 5 years ago, it declared that the incompetence One, hampers the federal government's ability to reliably report a significant portion of its assets, liabilities, costs, and other related information. Two, affects the federal government's ability to reliably measure the full cost as well as the financial and non-financial performance of certain programs and activities. Three, impairs the federal government's ability to adequately safeguard significant assets and properly record various transactions. And four, hinders the federal government from having reliable financial information to operate in an efficient and effective manner. In addition to the three major impediments, the GAO identified other material weaknesses. These are the federal government's inability to, one, determine the full extent to which improper payments occur and reasonably assure that appropriate actions are taken to reduce them, two, identify and resolve information security controls deficiencies and manage information security risks on an ongoing basis, and three, effectively manage its tax collection activities. In fact, get ready. Even the GAO and CBO underestimate the true nature of the economic and financial calamity facing this nation. On February 25, 2015, 2.5 years ago, Boston University professor of economics, Dr. Lawrence Kotlikoff, testified before the Senate Budget Committee about, quote, America's fiscal insolvency is generational and generational consequences. He flatly stated that, quote, our country is broke. It's not broke in 75 years or 50 years or 25 or 10 years. It's broke today. I'm quoting him. Indeed, it may well be in worse fiscal shape than any developed country, including Greece. He condemned Congress for cooking the books. He said Congress's economically arbitrary decisions as to what to put on and what to keep off the books have not been innocent. Successive Congresses, whether dominated by Republicans or Democrats, have spent the post-war accumulating massive net fiscal obligations, virtually all of which have been kept off the books. Professor Kotlikoff explained that the real debt picture is far worse than the federal government admits. I quote, the U.S. fiscal gap currently stands at $210 trillion. Remember now, he said this in 2015. The size of the U.S. fiscal gap, $220 trillion, is massive. He said it's 16 times larger than official U.S. debt numbers, which indicates precisely how useless official debt is for understanding our nation's true fiscal position, he said. In 2013, the fiscal gap stood at $205 trillion. In 2014, it was $210 trillion. So the country's true, he said, 2014 deficit, the increase in its fiscal gap was $5 trillion. It goes up $5 to $7 trillion a year. Not the $483 billion increase in official debt reported by the CBO in one-year deficit spending. The professor concluded what should be obvious to all of us. He said U.S. post-war generational policy is accurately characterized as take-as-you-go. Over the decades, Republican and Democratic Congresses' administrations have taken ever larger amounts of resources from young workers and transferred them to old retirees. And by the way, those of you who may be quote-unquote old retirees, same thing happened to you. Same thing was done to you. The resources taken from the young and given to the old were called in the main taxes. And the young were effectively told, don't worry, we're all calling these resources taxes, but when you're old, you'll receive massive transfer payments that more than make up for what you are paying now. Thus, there is a colossal transfer of wealth not yet created. This is me now. By younger people and future generations to the governing generation and generations since past, which will doom America's children and grandchildren if left unabated. The nation's increasing debt burden will wreak havoc on the economy in very specific ways. Higher interest rates, slower economic growth, weaker job markets, higher taxes, and higher inflation rates. The CBO notes that the enormous amount of government securities required to finance debt crowd out investments by individuals and businesses in the private marketplace, including in manufacturing, research, infrastructure, and small and large business opportunities. And because wages are determined mainly by workers' productivity, the reduction in investment would reduce wages as well, lessening people's incentive to work. And in order to compete for investments, both government and private borrowers will face higher interest rates. And while those rising rates will encourage individuals to save, the offsetting growth in interest costs will increase the cost of borrowing, further driving up the cost of debt, like the purchase of homes, the purchase of automobiles, capital used for R&D, and on and on and on. Now, do you want me to go on? I can go on at great length. When confronted with this debt debacle, and it is a debacle, the statists, which are Republicans and Democrats, their usual and deceitful bromide is a demagogic appeal to income redistribution. You hear it by Republicans today, people in the administration, leaders of the Republican Party in the House and Senate. That is to demand higher taxes on the rich or a more progressive income tax where everyone pays their fair share, quote unquote. The fact is that if the federal government confiscated every single penny produced by the private economy for the next decade, assuming a yearly average GDP of $20 trillion, and today it's about $18 trillion, 17.6, give or take, in the 11th year of taking every penny out of the economy, the aggregate national debt will still amount to trillions of dollars. It is a lie to say raising taxes on the rich or more progressive income tax will resolve anything. It'll resolve nothing. It'll simply speed up the end. The federal government's own statistics, as analyzed by the nonpartisan Tax Policy Center, belie the class warfare redistribution agitprop. In the 2014 tax year, 3 years ago, the top 20% of earners paid 84% of individual federal income taxes. And under Trump, McConnell, and Ryan, it'll be closer to 90%. The top 1% in 2014 of income earners paid nearly half of all the federal income taxes paid in the nation. The bottom 40% of earners paid no federal income taxes, and that's going to grow under Trump, McConnell, Ryan. Even more, they receive federal government subsidies, including the earned income tax credit, amounting to tens of billions of dollars. Ultimately, this is not merely about dreary yet didactic statistics, but as Dr. Williams insisted, it's about morality. The devastating consequences of wealth redistribution, intergenerational thievery, massive federal spending, endless borrowing, and unimaginable debt accumulation on American society, and most particularly on the rising generation and future generations, are a travesty. Stealing from the future does not establish the utopia promised by the statists. Washington, in his farewell address, urged his fellow citizens to, quote, avoid the accumulation of debt not only by shunning occasions of expense, but by vigorous exertions to discharge the debts, not throwing upon posterity, a.k.a. your children, the burden which we ourselves ought to bear. I'll be right back.
Mark Levin.
Have you ever had Mrs. Fields cookies? Not just cookies, but brownies and nibblers and so forth. We had them over Thanksgiving. A huge hit. They're unbelievable. They're better than ever. They're all handmade. If you're like me, your favorite part of going to the mall as a kid was stopping by Mrs. Fields. You remember that? It'll probably be your favorite part of going holiday shopping this year, too. Something about that first soft bite of the perfect chocolate chip cookie just makes you feel like a kid again. This holiday season, you can give your friends and family that same feeling of pure joy, the holiday gift arrangement from Mrs. Fields. Mrs. Fields cookies have been around for 40 years. Everyone knows and loves them. Remember the very first time you had one? It's like you finally knew what a chocolate chip cookie should taste like. They're so soft and chocolatey. Just thinking about those cookies makes my mouth water. And Mrs. Fields cookies are freshly baked. They are handmade. They're ready to enjoy right out of the box. so everyone can have what they've always wanted right now. So here's an exclusive deal for you, my beloved audience. Go to MrsFields.com. Do this right now. MrsFields.com. Simple enough. Click on the microphone at the upper right-hand corner and enter my last name as the code. That's Levin, L-E-V-I-N. And you'll get 25% off Mrs. Fields' best-selling Peace, Love, and Cookies tin. You get Nibbler. You can hear my mouth is watering. You get Nibbler's bite-sized cookies, brownie bites, and a heck of a lot more. So click on the microphone, enter promo code Levin, L-E-V-I-N, at MrsFields.com. MrsFields.com. Click the microphone, enter code Levin, and get the perfect holiday gift for 25% off. MrsFields.com, promo code Levin. I am telling you, they were a hit. Big, big hit, especially with me as I was consuming them. Now, we have a little problem with people who call themselves supply-siders. They only look at one side of the ledger. I just told you about the massive spending, the massive debt, the massive entitlements, the massive interest on the debt. And they think tax cuts will work our way out of this. I'm all for slashing corporate tax rates. I'm all for slashing individual tax rates to grow the economy so some of that money can be used to contribute toward debt reduction. But none of the money is used towards debt reduction. All the money is spent and then some. And then some. And then some. And then some more. I'll be right back.
He's here. Now, broadcasting from the underground command post, deep in the bowels of a hidden bunker, somewhere under the brick and steel of a nondescript building, we've once again made contact with our leader, Mark Levin.
Hello, everybody. Mark Levin here. Our number, 877-381-3811. 877-381-3811. I know this stuff is negative. But it is what it is. So the question is this, ladies and gentlemen. The question is this. Using sober thought, and you in this audience, you have sober thinking. You're not bamboozled. Nobody can dumb anything down to you. Why did we do this to ourselves? Why do we do this to ourselves? And I try to figure this out. Again, I'm not hawking plunder and deceit. It's just that I write these books and I've done so much research and so much thinking behind them. You know, they reflect my ideas. Here's the question. Can we simultaneously love our children but betray their generation and generations yet born? Is that not what we're doing? I know, it's upsetting, isn't it? Among the least acknowledged facts of American modernity is the extent to which parents, acting in their familial capacity, naturally and tenaciously, guard their young children from threat and peril, to the point of risking their own physical and economic security in extreme cases. However, as part of the political and governing community, that is the ruling generation, as I call it, many of these same parents, wittingly and unwittingly, join with other parents in tolerating, if not enthusiastically championing, disadvantageous and even grievous public policies that jeopardize not only their children's future, but the welfare of successive generations. To be clear, not all parental decisions are impactful or consequential in the lives of children. Obviously, not all decisions are equal. In fact, the most attentive and nurturing parents are not and cannot be conscious of every decision they make, inasmuch as the totality of such decisions is likely incalculable, even on a weekly or monthly basis. And in the healthiest families, the most considered parental decisions based on seemingly prudential judgments can and do produce unintended consequences. And, of course, the same can be said of decisions about public policy and governing in a relatively well-functioning community. However, there are accepted norms of behavior, a moral order, born of experience and knowledge, instinct and faith, teaching and reason, and love and passion, that provide definition for and boundaries between right and wrong, good and evil, fairness and injustice, that are applicable to families and societies alike. So a harmony of virtuous interests informed by tried and true traditions, customs, values, and institutions, and cultivated within families and the larger community, preserves and improves the human condition, one individual at a time, one generation to the next. Broadly speaking, this is the civil society. You've heard people talk about Edmund Burke. You've heard me talk about Edmund Burke. Well, there's a reason people talk about Edmund Burke, because he was so profound, among others. He was a political thinker who was born in Ireland, moved to England, became a prominent statesman in the 18th century. He explained that the civil society relies on an intergenerational continuum of the past, the living, and the unborn. Mark, what the hell does this have to do with it? It has to do with everything. Had a wonderful discussion today with an ambassador friend of mine. And we were talking about America and other things. American exceptionalism, American greatness. Where does this come from? He wrote, Burke did, that as the end of such a partnership cannot be obtained in many generations, it becomes a partnership not only between those who are living, but between those who are dead and those who are to be born. In other words, we have an obligation to past generations, as well as we do future generations. In fact, Burke went further, warning that those who forsake the intergenerational continuum condemn themselves, their children, and future generations to a grim existence. He wrote, "One of the first and most leading principles on which the Commonwealth and the laws are consecrated is lest the temporary, lest the temporary possessors and life renters in it, unmindful of what they have received from their ancestors or of what is due to their posterity, should act if they were the entire masters," which of course is the base of a progressivism, "that they should not think it among their rights to cut off the entail or commit waste on the inheritance by destroying at their pleasure the whole original fabric of society, hazarding to leave to those who come after them a ruin instead of a habitation, and teaching these successors as little to respect their contrivances as they had themselves respected the institutions of their forefathers." Is this not the mindset of the modern statist, a.k.a. progressive? History confirms Burke's observation. To enhance the moral order as parents nurturing their children, yet to abandon the moral order as members of the ruling generation, thereby contributing to predictably deleterious public policies with prospectively calamitous outcomes, is a decadence that leads to unstable and potentially oppressive or even tyrannical conditions, which in the end degrade and disassemble the civil society and consume their children's generation and generations beyond. Who the hell wrote that? I did. Reformation and recovery may be possible, but difficult and complicated, and typically only after the exaction of an enormous human toll. Well, why did Burke write what he wrote? Burke's commentary was motivated by his reflections on the decade-long French Revolution and his revulsion at the anarchy and horror it unleashed. In the ensuing more than two centuries, and up to this very moment, the world has witnessed even worse, much worse. This is not to say that all instances of civil and societal dislocation take the form of bloody revolution or civil war. Obviously, there are varying pathologies peculiar to particular doctrines, cultures, governing systems, and so on. There are also differing events and circumstances, some building over time and others descending more abruptly, that contribute to the character of the discontinuity. But violence is the ultimate exposure, is it not? Before Burke, Charles de Montesquieu, a French philosopher whose life predated the American Revolution but who was hugely influential in the Constitution's framers. He also wrote, of the disastrous aftermath of the civil society's abandonment. This has everything to do with the debt. This has everything to do with taxes. This has everything to do with public policy and Congress and the presidency and what's going on in this country. That's why I'm taking the time to go through this with you. At great risk, by the way, because a lot of people are tuning out. They want to hear, you know, issue after issue, fast, hot, sex, go, 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 go. Well, no, we're going to slow down today. Montesquieu explained, and this is famous, when that virtue ceases, ambition enters those hearts that can admit it, and avarice enters them all. Desires change their objects. That which one used to love, one loves no longer. One was free under the laws, one wants to be free against them. Each citizen is like a slave who has escaped from his master's house. What was a maxim is now called severity. What was a rule is now called constraint. What was vigilance is now called fear. There, frugality, not the desire to possess, is avarice. Formerly, the goods of individuals made up the public treasury. The public treasury has now become the patrimony of individuals. The republic is a cast-off husk, and its strength is no more than the power of a few citizens and the license of all. In modern America, the unraveling of the civil society had been subtly persistent, but it is now intensifying. Evidence of rising utopian statism, the allure of political demagogues and self-appointed masterminds, peddling abstractions and fantasies in pursuit of non-existent paradisiacal society, and the concomitant accretion of governmental power in an increasingly authoritarian and centralized federal leviathan, abounds. The ruling generation's governing policies are already forecast to diminish the quality of life of future generations. But that doesn't stop us, does it? Among other things, witness the massive welfare and entitlement state, which is concurrently expanding and imploding, and the brazen abandonment of constitutional firewalls and governing limitations. If not appropriately and expeditiously ameliorated, the effects will be dire, and the ruling generation knows it. And there are statistics that demonstrate it. There was in August 2014, a Wall Street Journal, NBC poll, and others that I won't bother you with. That is, the ruling generation, we know what we're doing, but we do it anyway. It is past time, and therefore imperative, that we, the ruling generation, acquaint ourselves with James Madison's uncomplicated and cautionary insight, written to bolster the proposed Constitution's ratification at the state conventions. In Federalist 51, Madison explained the essential balance between the civil society and governmental restraint. Here's what he wrote. But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections of human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place oblige it to control itself. So why do so many loving parents, as part of the ruling generation, we, abandon the civil society for the growing tyranny of a voracious central government that steals their children's future, thus condemning their children and unborn generations to a dangerously precarious and unstable environment, despite a large majority acknowledging the national decline for which they blame politicians? I think there's a number of possibilities. Are you interested in hearing them? Mr. Producer, are you interested in hearing them, or should I move along? Mr. Producer's interested, and that's good enough for me. When I come back, there will be more. We'll be right back.
Mark Levin.
why do so many loving parents abandon the civil society for the growing tyranny of a voracious central government that is going to destroy their children's future and condemn their children and unborn generations to bleakness, acknowledging the national decline for which they blame politicians? There's a number of possibilities. For example, language itself can contribute to the problem. The words generation, ruling generation, future generations could be imprecise. They can be thought of as merely theoretical, conceptual, unreal. So the growth of numerous offshoots intended to provide context and clarification, baby boomers, Generation X, millennials, Generation Z, etc. It's not my purpose to get into every one of these. But there are differences relating to various age groups, some big, others inconsequential, just as there are similarities and shared interests. It's also true of individuals generally. More to the point, parents are constantly thinking about and talking about their own children and interacting with them in their everyday lives. Obviously, children are flesh and blood, and their existence and condition are reality. Given that the future is not the here and now, and future generations are images or ideas of an amorphous group or groups of strangers, born and unborn, parents can delude themselves that their own children's immediate welfare, which they work to protect and improve, can be detached from the well-being of future generations. I'm not a psychologist, but this psychology also makes it easier for parents, as part of the current ruling generation, to downplay or ignore the longer-term and broader ruinous effects of contemporary public policies and reject any personal role or responsibility in contributing to them. It is a contradiction that usually originates with governing elites and statists who relentlessly reinforce and encourage it. They self-righteously advocate public policies that obligate future generations' labor and resources to their own real and perceived benefit, empowering governmental abuse via social engineering and economic depredation. They disguise the delinquency as compassionate and premised on good intentions, often insisting that their objectives will improve the prospects of those who most severely are burdened by them, the children. Also, the mastermind's tactics are disarming, if not seductive. Where utopianism is advanced through gradualism, as it is in our country, it can deceive an unsuspecting population, which is largely content and passive. It is sold as reforming and improving the existing society's imperfections and weaknesses without imperiling its basic nature. And under these conditions, it is mostly ignored, dismissed, or tolerated by much of the citizenry and celebrated by some. Transformation is deemed innocuous, well-intentioned, perhaps constructive, but not a dangerous trespass on fundamental liberties. Now, not all parents are downplaying or disregarding the soaring costs and heavy burdens of scores of public policies on their children and future generations. Many of us are acutely aware of the gathering storm of societal and economic disorder. We wish to do something about it. But the difficulty lies in not knowing how to effectively influence the omnipresence and complexity of massive governing enterprises that are less Republican and more autocratic. The masterminds and their flatterers are progressively immune to regular democratic processes and pressures, such as elections and citizen lobbying, unless, of course, the electoral results and policy demands comport with their own governing objectives. Otherwise, they have an escalating preference for rule by administrative regulation, executive decree, and judicial fiat, as the ends justifies the means. Many have themselves become entrapped in economically unsustainable governmental schemes, in which they are beneficiaries of and reliant on public programs, such as unfunded entitlements and pensions, to which they have contributed significantly into supposed trust funds and around which they have organized their retirement years. They also find self-deluding solace in the politically expedient and deceitful representations by the elites, which dismiss evidence of their own diversion and depletion of trust funds and its overall maladministration as the invention of doomsayers and scaremongers. And I go on and I go on to try and figure this out. But what I'm trying to get across to you now in the first half of this program, in an hour and a half, these issues are not going to go away. They're complex, they're becoming increasingly difficult and complicated. Much of this cannot anymore be resolved in any political environment. We have demagogues galore in both parties who tell us not only to ignore this, but that we can create new entitlements, new spending programs, borrow more money, continue to raise the debt ceiling as they congratulate themselves on the little things. I'll be right back.
And the Republicans don't like him, but America does. You can call Mark Levin at 877-381-3811.
You know, the downside of having an older car that you love, things start to go wrong. And they tend to snowball. Well, for me, there's an upside. I got extended vehicle service protection from CarShield for our 2010 model, yes, Camaro. First year it came out. I don't worry about big repair bills anymore. Getting covered by CarShield is just a great idea. It's affordable protection that can save you thousands of dollars for a covered repair. You know, a new fuel pump costs over $500, and replacing a water pump's over $1,000. CarShield even has plans that cover your car's computer, GPS, electronics, and a lot more. CarShield's the ultimate in extended vehicle coverage, and they get your favorite mechanic or dealership paid directly. Sign up today and get 24/7 roadside assistance and a rental car while yours is in the shop. Save yourself from high repair bills. Get covered by CarShield like I did before something goes wrong. Call 800-CAR-6100, mention code Levin, or visit CarShield.com. Use code Levin to save 10% right now. That's 800-CAR-6100, mention code Levin, or visit CarShield.com and use code L-E-V-I-N, Levin, to save 10%. A deductible may apply. What a wonderful, wonderful warranty. A wonderful service. I've got it on our Camaro. Well, I've done a lot of talking. I could do a lot more. I could talk about the student debt, student loan debt. We can get into that and other things, too. I'm trying to bring reality to what is a circus. I feel I have a microphone and millions of people who are listening, and hence a responsibility that while all this other nonsense is going on, and all these guests are on TV and radio, and all these so-called experts from prior administrations or future administrations, and guy that worked at the Fed, another guy who worked on this committee, another one who worked in that administration, go on and on and on about some. You need to know where the country is headed. I know I'm a voice in the wilderness. That's the way it is. I don't care. It is plunder and deceit. It is exploitation of the next generation and generations beyond, and they will not be able to come up for air. It's going to become an impossibility. It's not chiseled in granite. It's not chiseled in tablets, ladies and gentlemen, that the American society will live in perpetuity. Rome lived over 500 years. It doesn't exist anymore. That is the Roman Empire, the Roman government. The society is gone. Athens before it, gone. Europe, in my view, is essentially gone, or it will be soon enough. You can see little examples of collapsing societies. You can begin to see little examples in our own country, within some cities and states. What happens when an economy collapses? Well, of course, the rule of law collapses too. More and more, you can see federal judges, members of Congress, presidents, more and more bureaucrats themselves, insisting on operating outside the constitutional order. The bigger the government gets, the more ubiquitous it gets, the more resources it gets, the less it has to spend, the more it has to borrow. The more it seeks to control, the more that is out of control. The more it seeks to provide, the less we have. That's because you're destroying, through politicians and bureaucrats and their ideological intelligentsia, you are destroying what they cannot create: a healthy, vibrant, civil society, where individuals, for the most part, make decisions on their own, where individuals, for the most part, plan their own economies, that is, their budgets, their food menu, their this and the rest. The bureaucrat, the politician, their ideological intelligentsia, reject it. They are control freaks. They are power hungry. This is the nature of progressivism. The other day I said, I believe it was yesterday, look around. Look around you. See the benefits of liberty, capitalism, private property rights, the market system, competition, wealth creation, profits. Look around you. You happen to live, you happen to have been born into the most prosperous, spectacular society mankind has ever known. You could have been born in North Korea. By chance, you could have been born in Cuba and still be there. You could have been born in Venezuela and still be there. You could have been born perhaps at a different time and place, in Stalin's Russia, in Mao's China. There is hell on earth today and there was hell on earth before, but you were born in America. You were blessed. I don't know why me and I don't know why you. But we are and we're blessed. We're here. It is crucial that we understand why this is the most fabulous society on the face of the earth. It's the most fabulous society earth has ever known. It's crucial that we understand our belief system, our values, our principles. It's crucial that we defend our institutions and our traditions and our customs. It is crucial that we not become beholden to this federal leviathan, the politicians who run it and the bureaucrats who manage it, or we will be bought. We will cease to join the chorus of people, a shrinking chorus of people, who are trying to inform our fellow citizens of the dangers that lie ahead, and not that far ahead. And not that far ahead. This is why I condemn what the Democrat Party has become. Do you know, when you look at people like presidents like Grover Cleveland, the Democrat Party was a fairly conservative party. I'm talking about post-slavery. The Democrat Party was a fairly conservative party. Pro-capitalism, pro-private property rights, and so forth. But it's like the movie The Alien, which I never saw, but I saw commercials for it, or movies like that. Or the body snatchers. The early populists, or the People's Party as they called it in the 1870s, were devoured by the progressives. The progressives then devoured the Democratic Party. And by the way, they devoured the Republican Party too. But there were still elements, significant elements within the Republican Party that resisted it, and still do. That's how you get a Theodore Roosevelt, one of the leading, most aggressive progressives, and a Republican, and Calvin Coolidge. Just a few decades later, who rejected progressivism completely and utterly. That is why you have a Susan Collins, who is really quite diabolical. She is a progressive who runs under the Republican banner, and yet is more powerful than any Democrat in the United States Senate in thwarting any aspect of a conservative agenda, because she's the tail that wags the 52 majority, the slim majority of Republicans in the Senate. And there's two or three or four of them that know it. And what does she always fight for? More government. More Medicaid. More Obamacare. In many ways, she is a political saboteur. Which is exactly why the Democrats and the media, all progressives, continue to promote her and protect her and champion her. And from time to time, McCain serves that role, and they do the same for him. And from time to time, Murkowski of Alaska serves that role, and they do the same for her. And from time to time, Corker plays that role, and they do the same for him, because they know it only takes a few to sabotage the many. And yet, ironically, the vast majority of what the Republicans are doing in the House and the Senate have nothing to do with conservatism or American constitutionalism or our founding principles or our values and belief systems, even though they are aggressively defended by their surrogates, including in conservative and pseudo-conservative media. Barack Obama wasn't the only one who drove up the debt. He had partners in that, the Republicans. He had partners in that. The Wall Street Journal editorial page. Every time the debt ceiling comes up, they start trashing the Tea Party and trashing conservatives. And others. And others who are creating a fate that is bleak and dire and impoverished. They don't even believe half the things they write or say. They can't possibly. They can't possibly. So what happens when you have an economic calamity is you have a societal calamity. The rule of law is replaced with the non-rule of the jungle. You have perfect examples of it today. Perfect examples of it in places like Venezuela. And yet we read that Bernie Sanders is getting ready to run for president again. Bernie Sanders used to applaud Venezuela. He used to applaud Chavez. Now he points to Scandinavia. Scandinavia? I have no prejudice whatsoever, people who live in Scandinavia, but they're really quite irrelevant when it comes to the world scene. Aren't they? No offense. We're Americans. We're special. Our system is exceptional. It's unique. John Locke was very, very important to the American Revolution. He was cited over and over and over again. He was the most widely read philosopher by the colonists, and they were widely read. His second treatise on government, and I've written about this, that not everybody buys the books or reads John Locke, so I comment about it on radio. That's why I love these multiple media platforms. And he wrote much about the civil society, the whole notion of unalienable rights, God-given natural law, and so forth and so on. While many have written about it, Locke was primarily important to the founders. How do we know? They told us that. That's how we know. These ideas of God-given unalienable rights, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We didn't get those from Nancy Pelosi or John Conyers or Mitch McConnell or Chuck Schumer. We didn't get those from Republicans or Democrats or whatever. We exist outside the party structure. We exist outside our own governing structure. When you get a chance, reread the Declaration of Independence, which the progressives trash all the time. Wilson trashed it. Other intellectuals, progressive intellectuals at the time, trashed it. Theodore Roosevelt trashed it. Coolidge came to its defense. Obama trashed it by rewriting it, if you will. Reagan promoted it. That's the battle right there of who we are and what we believe. All right, I know I'm getting far afield. I'll be right back.
Mark Levin.
froze. And I don't even know what an ENCO is. But all the little engineer techie types, they know what it is. All right. You know, Uber disclosed a breach of 57 million passengers and drivers' records. Hackers accessed personal information like names and driver license numbers of the drivers and names, email addresses, phone numbers of passengers, on and on and on. You know, though this breach was just recently announced, this personal information, it was actually stolen over a year ago. If you're only monitoring your credit, your identity can still be stolen in ways you may not detect. Good thing there's LifeLock. LifeLock detects a wide range of identity threats, threats you may miss by just monitoring your credit, like someone stealing from your 401k or committing a crime in your name. And if there's a problem, a U.S.-based identity restoration specialist will work to fix it. No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but LifeLock can help you see more threats to your identity. Go to LifeLock.com, LifeLock.com, or call 1-800-LifeLock, 1-800-LifeLock. Use promo code Levin, that's L-E-V-I-N, for 10% off your LifeLock membership. Visit LifeLock.com and save 10% right now. Carrie, San Francisco, California, the great KSFO, go!
Hi there.
Hello.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for taking my call.
You got it.
So I wanted to see if you were aware, if your millennial listeners like myself are aware, that the most destructive Ponzi scheme in their life probably isn't Social Security, but it's actually the direct federal student lending program.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the government nationalized it under Barack Obama, too. The taxpayer is now on the hook for every penny.
Absolutely, and they're on the hook for every penny regardless of whether or not the students or their parents repay those loans, because the dirty open secret that you can verify by looking at any of the annual reports online from DOE is that they took earmarks out of U.S. bond auctions to make these loans in the first place. They borrowed the money to make the loans to parents and students. All of that 1.6 trillion now is already counted in that 20 trillion national debt. But when you repay the Department of Education, they take that money, 55 billion I think they're getting a year now. They turn around, they give it to the general fund of the U.S. Treasury where the Congress spends it, but not one penny on paying down that sovereign debt that funded the loan.
Mm-hmm.
And that, my friends, is a huge problem.
Yeah, that sounds like it to me. By the way,
yeah.
I'm going to send you a book called Plunder and Deceit that I was talking about earlier, and I have a whole section on exactly what you're talking about.
Well, so, it was you reading that section that inspired me to call, so thank you.
So don't hang up, Carrie, okay? Now tell me, how old are you?
I'm 31.
And most people your age aren't even giving this a second thought, are they?
Well, you know, it's such a problem. It's a problem for me. School debt's a problem for me. It's a problem for my generation. I think more and more people are becoming educated as to, you know, the policy mistakes that cause the price to skyrocket, allow the price to stay high, and are just disingenuous. You know, vote for Bernie Sanders. Are you insane? You know, I mean.
And yet many do.
I'm sorry?
And yet many do.
They do, and they don't realize that, you know, this policy of direct federal student lending that was supposed to, quote-unquote, make college affordable, et cetera, was passed by rider to Obamacare, not a single Republican vote. And what did it do? You know, it's only been in place since, you know, when was the ACA passed?
And what have the Republicans done about it?
Well, they're going to come clean up behind and take advantage of it. You know, they're going to cut my interest tax deduction to nothing. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they're going to get in these disingenuous arguments about whether or not the federal government profits from student loans. Well, the current Congress profits from them. I don't know about my generation when we can't pay this $20 trillion and counting.
What Carrie is saying and what I wrote about in Plunder and Deceit, too, is this is newfound money, quote-unquote, for Congress to spend. Right, Carrie?
That's exactly what it is.
Gotta run. Excellent call. Don't hang up. We'll get you a book. I'll be right back.
He's here. Now, broadcasting. broadcasting from the underground command post. Deep in the bowels of a hidden bunker, somewhere under the brick and steel of a nondescript building, we've once again made contact with our leader, Mark Levin.
Everybody, Mark Levin here. Our number 877-381-3811, 877-381-3811. What to do about North Korea? Is my idea so stupid? I'm just asking you the truth here. To take the same general policy ideas, actually the same general actions that Reagan took to defeat the Soviet Union in order to contain North Korea. And in order to contain North Korea, you must contain China. The president went to Southeast Asia. He visited a number of countries in the Pacific Rim. He visited the Philippines. He visited Japan. He visited Vietnam. He visited China. Maybe there's another country in there, but that's all I can remember. And they went to this big event, and apparently he and this Mao Tse-tung wannabe, Xi, hit it off. Got along great. And today, of course, with the new relationship we have with China, now that we're chums with the president of China, who is stealing our technology, building up military, grabbing control over the South China Sea, and all kinds of cool stuff, there's North Korea firing its most dangerous weapon yet. An ICBM that's in the air, what did I read, for 50 minutes or so? Is that right? And again, it's shot towards Japan, one of our closest allies. Japan, which has no nukes. And South Korea, which was denuked by us as a way of trying to appease North Korea from becoming a nuclear power. It didn't work. So, just to reiterate, those of you who listen every day, 3 hours at a time, I really, really appreciate it. But there are other people who come and go in a program like this, and I just want to reiterate. What I believe should be done is that we strongly encourage South Korea to take back the equivalent of 100 nuclear warheads, which we removed from South Korea during the George H.W. Bush administration. That's number one. Number two, we should strongly encourage Japan to nuke up. Japan is a responsible government. It is a parliamentary system of sorts. It is a close ally. And nuclear weapons in the hands of the inbred Kim Jong Fat Boy in North Korea, that's a threat. Nuclear weapons in Japan, that's not a threat. That's number two. Number three, we must build up our military. And the President of the United States said today correctly, we need more funds for our military. You know, one night, you know, after the holidays when we can all focus on this, I think I'm going to really get into what's been happening to the United States military. It has been absolutely appalling. And it's leaving us vulnerable in this country and in other places around the world. It's leaving us vulnerable. And it is very dangerous for the men and women who serve. The number of jet fighters that have been going down, the number of ships that have been crashing one into the other, the truncated training that takes place now, the cannibalization of weapons, that is, of jets to jets, of ships to ships. I mean, it's ridiculous. I just spent 2 hours explaining how we're spending like drunken Marxists. And the one area that's taking it in the neck is the military. We don't have a military-industrial complex in this country, something Ike feared in the 50s. It's not the 50s. We have a welfare industrial complex in this country. That's what's completely out of control. Subsidies, entitlements, direct payments, whatever. So number one, I mentioned South Korea, nukes. Number two, Japan, yes, nukes. Number three, we should have a permanent carrier fleet in the South China Sea, and we should announce it. They can build their pretend little islands and militarize them. There's no way we can stop that now, because Barack Obama did not confront it in any effective way, or any ineffective way, just didn't confront it. We can now say, we're not building temporary islands in international waters, but our fleet, a carrier fleet, will remain there permanently. And the jet fighters and the sailors that go with it, and the accompanying ships that go with it. That's what we say. So we neutralize them in the South China Sea. Number four, as I've been talking about now for a very long time, we punish the Chinese banks. You know, the Chinese currency, the Chinese financial system, is teetering. And the reason it's teetering is it's not real, it's pretend. The government decides the value of the currency. Our currency, the dollar, floats on the open market throughout the world, for all you globalists out there. Yes, yes. And so it has a value, it floats, and the value is determined by the market. That is, the strength of the dollar as perceived by other countries and as used against other currencies. That's not the case with China. That's not the case with the Chinese currency. The Chinese banks rely on our banks because our currency is legitimate. We can severely damage the Chinese economy any time we choose through its financial system, through its banks. And in my humble opinion, we should make it clear to Xi, the Mao/Stalin of China now, that's exactly what we're going to do. That we've asked him politely enough, we've cajoled him, we've done everything we can to get him to cut them off, and he's not cutting off North Korea. Well, look at this, he didn't send them coal this month. They're sending him plenty of stuff through the black markets. They're allowing their corporations and their other businesses to work through the black market. If China didn't want anything passing over the border between China and North Korea, it wouldn't be passing over the border or through the border with China and North Korea. But it does. China continues to prop up North Korea, as does Russia. As does Russia. All the code pink Republicans out there, you don't hear them anymore talking of Putin, do you, Mr. Producer? Oh, yeah, yeah, all the code pink nationalist Republicans out there talking of Putin. Well, he's not so bad. He's awful. He's always been awful. He's another one. He's in Syria. He's in Iran. He's in North Korea. And we can punish him, too, by unleashing our energy production. We would destroy what's left of the Russian economy, and it ain't much, given how much they pour into their military as well, and how much he, among others, steal from the people of Russia. I'm not saying go to war. You don't have to go to war. Do we go to war with the Soviet Union to destroy it? But back to China. China and North Korea are attached at the hip. North Korea is a puppet state of China. It is a satellite state. China likes the fact that North Korea has given us hell, and Japan, and South Korea, and distracting us. China likes the fact that we have three carrier fleets and at least one nuclear sub sitting out there off North Korea, while China's involved in other stuff in other parts of the world. China likes that. As they steal our technology, as they have committed one act of cyber warfare after another against us, and they have, as well as the Russians, but the myopic, obsessive focus only on the Russians to the exclusion of the Chinese is a huge mistake. They're both tapping into our databases to gather information and steal technology in order to build up not their societies, but their militaries. This is what I think needs to be done. I'm not a general. I'm not a foreign policy or national security trained expert, but I do know history. Older history, modern history. And modern history tells me that China would take a very serious second look at what it's doing if it knew that South Korea and Japan were going to have nukes, if it knew that it was a matter of permanent American military policy to have a fleet in the South China Sea, not temporary to deal just with North Korea, but permanent to deal with them, and that we were unleashing our massive economic power and financial power that exists as of this moment against its economic and financial power, where it wouldn't stand a chance. Our economy is 5 times the size of China's economy, 4.5 times the size of China's economy. Anyway, for what it's worth, I'll be right back.
Mark Levin.
Question. The Democrats are now saying, you know, we're going to shut down the government unless DACA, the unconstitutional DACA that Obama put in place, isn't enshrined statutorily. Do you think for one second, if they thought the quote-unquote Dreamers would vote 3/4 or 60% Republican, that they would be throwing down the gauntlet, willing to shut down the government for DACA? Of course not. Of course not. They insist that the debt ceiling be increased, or they'll shut down the government. Now, the irony there is if you don't increase the debt ceiling, the government is shut down. But they insist on increasing the debt ceiling. Why? Because, ladies and gentlemen, you have a political party built on redistribution of wealth and balkanization. And there it is. The Democrat Party has created nations within our nation. Nations within our nation. They've created these ethnic, religious, sexual, however you want to define them, you know what they are. Nations, if you will, or groupings within the nation. Having balkanized the nation, having disunited the nation, they now use their positions in government to accommodate or appeal to or appease these various groups or nations within the nation. So DACA is crucial to them. Lifting the debt ceiling, that's the heart and soul of what they do, borrow and spend. And they must borrow and spend. They must redistribute wealth. They must reward their supporters and punish their opponents. Hurricane relief, they say. We need more money for hurricane relief. We are spending tens of billions of dollars on hurricane relief. They would shut down the entire government, if they could, for hurricane relief. No, there's a reason they do what they do, and it's not about humanity. It's not about country. It's about them, their power. They're power hungry, the maintenance of power, the attainment of power. Power. People say follow the money. That's fine. Follow the power. That's the bottom line. The Democrat Party has been devoured by this radical leftist European mindset. There's almost nothing, in terms of American principles, there's almost nothing in the character of the leadership of the Democrat Party that connects with American principles and American history, which is also one of the reasons they trash it so frequently, as does their base, which is also one of the reasons why Bernie Sanders is so popular. There's no connection either there. Bernie Sanders talks about Scandinavia more than he'll ever talk about America's founding. He'll talk about Scandinavia more than he'll ever talk about capitalism and private property rights and individualism and all those things. Look to Scandinavia. And even when he points to Scandinavia, he lies about it. Scandinavia is not only on the decline, it's been on the decline. Among the highest rates of alcoholism, among the highest rates of suicide. And frankly, what do these little countries contribute to society overall? Not a hell of a lot. Why would you switch the American system, the American mindset, for the Scandinavian system and mindset? What the hell? Kind of creepy. So the Democrats will fight like hell for what they want, and the Republicans won't. Because there are saboteurs. There are ideological saboteurs who are more concerned with their own legacies, the case of McCain as an example, or more concerned about their own the way they're approached by media, like Susan Collins, I guess is how I'd put it. They have their own agendas. And so they're very well prepared to destroy what's been campaigned on, break promises, refuse to advance a rational, conservative agenda. And this is why they're feted. This is why they're celebrated. As independent, don't you know? You don't have any independent Democrats, and they're not celebrated as independents. If they go off the reservation, they're attacked. Let's go to Jeff, Reno, Nevada, the great KDON, KDWN, home of my buddy Rick Harrison, who I haven't heard from lately, over there. A great show, this Pawn Stars show. I'm really hooked on it, always have been, as well as a few others there on the History Channel. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Mark, really glad I got through, long-time listener. I just wanted to add to what you said about China and Japan. So I think one thing we could encourage Japan to do is redo Article 5 of their constitution, basically allowing them to be an offensive military and build up their military with offensive capabilities, which would put pressure on China. In addition to that...
All right, slow down a second. I've looked at this. Japan already has the authority, the legal authority, to build nuclear weapons. Are you aware of that?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And I agree with that. But I mean a conventional offensive military, one that says if they wanted to, they could go out and touch China or North Korea without having been attacked first.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm certainly not opposed to that. But I just want to be abundantly clear. Japan has the legal authority and the industrial capacity to nuke up. It already has that ability. All right, Jeff, I appreciate your call very much. Ladies and gentlemen, I shall return.
Blasting conservative fire. The Mark Levin Show. Call in now at 877-381-3811.
You know, getting a good night's sleep is easier said than done, especially if you hear a noise downstairs. Now, what do you do in that situation? You could turn on all the lights and keep watch, sleep with one eye open, or you can rest easy, knowing that your home and family are protected with Simply Safe. Each Simply Safe system is a complete security arsenal with motion sensors, glass break sensors, entry sensors, and a high-definition security camera. You'll have everything you need to keep your family safe. Order Simply Safe online in minutes. Have it on your doorstep this week and set it up under an hour. No tools, no hard wiring. Just open the box, plug it in. Just open the box, plug it in. And you'll be protected with professional home security. With Simply Safe, there are no contracts, no hidden fees, the best technologically advanced system you can imagine, no wires, and 24/7 professional monitoring is just $14.99 a month. Get Simply Safe and get some rest. Here's what you do. Go to simplysafemark.com and get a special 10% discount when you order today. That's SimplySafeMark.com for 10% off your order. SimplySafeMark.com. Well, Tom in Fairfax, Virginia, the great WMAL. Go!
How you doing, Mark?
Okay. Go right ahead.
Well, I'm a first-time caller, but a long-time listener. And out here in the great Commonwealth of Virginia, you know it's a state that's going blue, if not already is, right? And I live in Northern Virginia.
That's correct.
And at work and among, you know, the soccer parents and such, we have debates about, hey, what do we do with, you know, the debt, national debt? And I say, look, we need to start pulling back. I said, because we can't keep financing the rest of the world vis-a-vis free meals and schools. And we see it at the county, state, and the federal level. And they say, well, that's not compassionate. And so I get stumped because how do you say, look, I'm trying to look out for all of us who are taxpaying citizens and here legally, without sounding like a complete jerk and this, like, inhumane individual. When actually I'm being very humane because I'm looking out for the person across from me who's disagreeing.
Well, I think the way I would put it is I would say, I, meaning you, I'm the one looking out for the younger people in this country. I'm the one addressing over $200 trillion in unfunded liabilities. I'm the one questioning our generation's rape of the United States Treasury. Massive debt, so much so that we can't even keep track of it. I, meaning you, I'm the one concerned about how future generations are going to pay for entitlements. I'm the one who's concerned about decisions being made today by parent-teachers associations and organizations and school boards and teachers' unions and principals and other administrators that are destroying the viability of the school system for decades to come. I am the one who is concerned about property taxes going so high that people, particularly elderly people, lose their homes. I am the one, meaning you, I am the one who's compassionate, who cares about my fellow man and so forth. If people are hungry, we have a massive food stamp program. If people need medical care, we have a massive Medicaid program. If people need housing assistance, we've got more programs and departments to help with housing assistance than I can shake a stick at. We're not talking about helping the very, very poor anymore. We're talking about massive redistribution of wealth where everybody's subsidized for something. Billionaires, millionaires, the middle class, everybody's subsidized for something, which means economic calamity down the road. That's what I would say. It took me 4 minutes, 3 minutes. That's it.
Got it. Well, thank you very much.
I'm going to send you a copy of Plunder and Deceit, too. All the information's in there, so don't hang up, Tom, okay?
Mark, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and keep doing what you're doing, and I'll keep listening and watching you.
You too, my brother. If we were only talking about these things, school lunch programs and so forth, we wouldn't be going broke. But notice they had to destroy the health care system. Destroy the health care system. Why did they do that? Why did they destroy the healthcare system? Because it's about power. They want to force us all into a system that they control and organize because they are our social engineers. They believe in radical egalitarianism. This is a very dangerous ideology that we're dealing with. Thank you for your call, my friend. Let us see. Donald in Boise, Idaho, Sirius Satellite. Go, please.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, so you were talking a little bit earlier about like McCain, Hillary, them, how they've gone off these rampages, so to speak, on power of control. But the issue that we run into as America isn't the fact that our
By the way, I don't think I even mentioned Hillary tonight, but I wouldn't disagree with you.
No, you said McCain, but, I mean, Hillary's right there with them. But the issue that, at least I've seen from my experience with America, isn't that our representatives are corrupt, but we as the people are ignorant. We don't do our research. We don't fact check our representatives. So when they say,
well, how do you know the people are ignorant as opposed to the people like the way things are going? I mean, think about it for a second. People get benefits without consequence because the consequences are shoved off on someone else or shoved off into the future. It's a pretty, pretty cool thing when you can live out a Ponzi scheme and you're being told, you're doing it and you're actually voting for people who are compassionate, who are promoting it. I think a lot of people aren't ignorant. I think a lot of people are living for the day. And they don't give a damn about anybody else. What?
But I see where you're coming from, but when you look at, like, voter turnout, you see massive amount of voters turn out for national elections, even though the actual laws and regulation and statutes that go and affect people the most readily are those of your local elections. And you have very minimum turnout for local mayor, county commissioners, and such government, where the rules that they put in actually affect more people.
Well, they don't affect more people. It depends on what they're doing. They affect the people in their community. There's no question about it. But, for instance, your town had nothing to do with Obamacare. Your town has nothing to do with the open border or south of the border. So it just depends. I'm not in favor of government abuse at any level. But thank you for your call, sir. Let us go to Ray, Long Island, the great WABC. Go.
Hey, Mark. Great delivery on your part there. But I'm wondering, why don't we just look at the human aspect of it, the humane aspect? We don't know. The majority of the people in the world don't want war. Why should we start arming everybody? People like shooting off their cannons. It's ridiculous. We got to stop this person. We have to stop the war thing. And we just need peace, overall peace.
What the hell are you talking about?
What the hell am I talking about?
What war thing are you talking about? Stop the war thing.
Yes. War is money, wealth, aggression, and repression.
No, sir. This may come as a shock to you, but war is not about money and aggression when you're dealing with very, very dangerous foes like North Korea. The problem is, you don't know much about history. Your mindset was the mindset of the isolationists prior to World War II. And that resulted in the rise of these dictators who created havoc. You may remember World War II. Maybe you read a little bit about it. Maybe you had a comic book that taught you a few things about it. That doesn't mean you're a radical interventionist and you get involved in every conflict that's taking place on every part of the world. But when you have a country that is acquiring and has acquired now nuclear weapons and the capacity to hit the United States, that's threatening to kill our president, threatening to hit our cities. You see, sir, to come across like you with bumper sticker statements that I'm for peace. You're not for peace. You're a schmuck.
Anything. They're just shooting off their cannons because...
They're not just shooting off their cannons, you idiot. Those are intercontinental ballistic missiles. And if you have a nuclear warhead on them, it can blow New York City off the face of the earth. Now, you might think that you're for peace. You're not for peace. You're an idiot. We're dealing with a real country with real nuclear weapons that can hit real cities. You got it? Now get off my phone, you idiot. And I'm sick of people like this. Here we have a guy in North Korea who is threatening us. And this guy's blind to it. It's America's fault because we're filled with profiteers. Profiteers for what? It's incredible to me. Hey, don't you want faith support peace? Of course I support peace. This is all about peace and humanity. The reason I get angry about this, ladies and gentlemen, is here we are confronting evil, an enemy, right in our face, who's threatened to kill the President of the United States, threatens to hit Guam, threatens to hit the continental United States. Reminds me of the idiots driving around with their stickers that say, coexist. Coexist? Wow. I want to coexist, you want to coexist, but there's some people out there who don't want to coexist. There we are. Mac. Hey, what are you for warmongers, you just for money, and Mark. Got to deal with a schmuck like that. Unfortunately, the country's filled with them. They're called Bernie Sanders supporters. Greg, Lorton, Virginia, the great WMAL. How are you, sir?
Hello, Mark. How are you tonight?
Fine, thank you.
Okay, I can't believe that last idiot, and I'm almost speechless. But what I wanted to say is that something I noticed when I was raising my son back in the late 90s is that they wanted to stop keeping score of the T-ball game. because they didn't want anybody to lose. And I really think that, you know, that's part of the mentality of our country where it's like, oh, no, just try hard, and then that's okay. And you know what? That's not okay. You either win or you lose. And if you don't put forth the effort to win, then you don't get anything.
I actually think, as you tee this up, I actually think it's even worse than what we've been saying over the past several years. This is actually, it's not that we, you know, everybody wins. It, to me now, as I'm listening to you and as I think about all this, it's about promoting at a very young age this notion of radical egalitarianism. That's what it is. It's not a conspiracy or anything. It's a mentality. It's a mindset. You can't have people who are successful at sports, even at that level and that age, successful at business. You hear the Republicans talking about it. We're going to get the rich here. You know, if you're in a blue state and you're rich, you're going to pay more taxes. It's like, excuse me? Excuse me? And you're making these arguments? Anyway, go ahead, Greg.
And you know, I've made the decision that because of the way our government is going, I know two things. I know that my health care is on me. I have to stay healthy, and there's no help coming ever. And then the next thing is I am so concerned about eventually our personal property rights being violated where the government is going to come knock on my door and tell me I have to give up my property.
And just remember, a desperate government does desperate things. And that's why you want to limit the size of the government, limit the reach of the government, it's why the framers limited the role of the government and divided it in different parts and so forth and so on. And much of that's been reversed. We have a very centralized, powerful government. The states have to live at its behest now. Individuals have to live at its behest in many respects. We can't pick the kind of health care plan we want outside of, oh, look at the options we have, outside of the options the government gives us. I mean, it's... And that's why it becomes a very, very dangerous thing. There are ways to let off steam in a society that a centralized government destroys. For instance, mobility, competition, different states with different histories, people who go to different states because they like the states in terms of what kind of laws they have or laws they don't have or the business climate or whether they have the death penalty or don't have the death penalty, on and on and on. And more of those things, that is, the variety, the diversity among states, the are being destroyed. And so when the government makes a decision, it affects everybody. And there's no way out. The government makes a decision, you will live under the decision of the government. There's no escaping it. And so those little areas where you could let off steam in a free society like ours was, at least more so than it is now, it's still free, just not as free as it ought to be, those things are destroyed. And so what happens is every decision the federal government makes, we all sit on the edge of our chairs as to the extent we know what decisions they're making to find out what they are, how it'll affect our lives, you know, how many more bureaucrats are involved, how many more pieces of paper we have to file, whether or not we can own a gun here, whether or not we can do that over there. And if we are not complying with it, more and more of these laws and so forth, we're not suffocated by them, then we are considered kind of oddballs or radicals or part of a militia or whatever it is. And this continues to get worse and worse and worse, and then it reaches a peak. And that's my great concern.
A very valid concern, because I'm there. I mean, I'm flat out scared. You know, I'm fearful. And the problem is that my generation was not educated properly in the ways of the Constitution.
Greg, I spoke too much. Mr. Producer is shouting, you got to get out. You got to get out. Call again tomorrow. I apologize. We'll be right back.
Mark Levin.
Wow, this is big. I have a fabulous deal for you from my friends at Blindster.com. That's Blinds, T-E-R.com. Ready? Right now, for Cyber Monday, you get 50% off your entire order. But you better hurry because the sale ends this week. This week. They sent me free samples first and made it so easy to measure and install. You know, I recently placed an order for Blindster for plantation shutters. I just love the way Kyle Cox runs his family business. It's customer service at its best. Kyle exemplifies the American dream, starting the entire online blinds industry with just $5,000 and now selling on average a custom blind every 60 seconds. Kyle shows you how to measure and install, so you don't have to throw your money away by hiring a so-called pro. Plus, if your blinds don't fit, even if you goofed up, Kyle will remake the blinds and the sizes you need for free. You only pay shipping. Don't miss this 50% off deal. 50%. Enter promo code MARK at checkout. That's blindster.com for quality custom-made window treatments of every kind. Blindster.com. Promo code MARK. Again, blindster.com, promo code MARK. It's Tuesday. I really don't want you to miss out on this. Jump into it now. You can get 50% off your entire order, and the prices are already quite good. By the way, a federal district judge ruled as I anticipated, because this particular judge follows the law. The president, of course, has the constitutional authority to appoint the acting director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Remember that discussion? Where the outgoing leftist kook, who's now running for governor of Ohio, the Democrat, said, no, he gets to do that. The president can't do that. Also, very quickly, here's Cokie Roberts on ABC's This Week Sunday. Go!
The fact that people are willing to be public can change things. I mean, we all talked about for years.
A little bit at a time.
You know, don't get in the elevator with him. You know, and the whole, every female in the press corps knew that, right? Don't get in the elevator with him.
And by the way, the him? Is who, Mr. Producer? John Conyers. But Joe Scarborough didn't have any problem with the iconic John Conyers. Apparently he got in the elevator with him all the time. Ladies and gentlemen, we salute our armed forces, police officers, firefighters, and emergency personnel. I'll see you right here on the radio tomorrow. We'll have a brand new Levin TV for you tomorrow night as well. God bless. Thanks for listening. I really appreciate it. See you tomorrow.